Hello, and welcome to Game Brain, a board game podcast with Matthew Robinson and his gaming group. I continue to not be Matthew Robinson. I'm Tom Donnelly. Matty is adding a Hinterbunkler to his shadow cabinet and leaving us to place media markers on our own. Hashtag Z-Marker. Hashtag greatest of all time. This is round four, turn two. And this week we'll be reviewing one of our all-time favorite games, a game that is on our 8x8 challenge, Gaia Project. And of course, we'll also be talking about this round's theme, which is old school. We'll be going back in time, talking about the intersection of games and our lives. Or we would be, if I had any guest sitting across from me this week, except the marcher to his own drum, the prodigy of crotchety philosophy, the non-gamer himself, Dimitri Portnoy!
Tom, it's such a pleasure to be with you this morning.
Здравствуйте, господин Портной. Как вы поживаете?
I'm very good. We will be talking about games and other things. And I'm so glad to be doing this podcast with you, my friend.
Do you realize it's almost 30 years we've been friends?
I did not want to mention that, but I do realize that very much. And it's not almost 30 years. Well, yes, it is almost 30 years, but we might as well round it up.
29 and change.
Yes,
that's
yes.
What it is. Crazy.
We've known each other longer than you, the listener, has been alive.
I'm not sure that's entirely our demographic, but we'll go with it. Let's jump right into it. We got some stuff to talk about on game night, but for that, we have a song. Here you go.
Stereo effects. This is the first time I've listened to it through headphones.
It's amazing.
Oh, yeah.
It's amazing. Oh. Thank you so much to our European listener who gave us this. It is unbelievable. I listened to it in the car. I just love it that much. Last week, we only talked about a single game night because we recorded prior to game night. So this week,
we have three.
We do. Not one, not two, but three. Last week at Tom's game night, we played Dune. We had six players, the perfect number, and we played Dune. We promised Matty that we would try and get Dune in before he went to Babyland, and sure enough, we paid it off. We did not have the new edition of Dune. That is still yet to come. We were hoping that it would come in, but played.
The word is that the new Dune does not have any new rules.
They
tweak it a little bit,
yeah. But which, by the way, frankly, it needs to be right. I mean, it's an old game that has a FAQ that is 100 pages long, and the WBC, which is the World Board Gaming Championships, has a Dune tournament every year, and there is a fairly significant list of house rules that they play by that most people consider to be the canon for the way you need to play this game going forward. There's a lot of it's one of those games with extreme player powers that break the game in certain ways, and how those player powers can intersect one another can sometimes be a real nightmare to figure out if you don't have an experienced rules lawyer by your side, ready to work pro bono for you, and we no longer do.
I played Harkonnen. Tom, you played the Bene Gesserit, your
it's
favorite.
True.
I think Harkonnen is my favorite. Paul was stuck with the Fremen.
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 We'll go.
Excuse me. Sure. I'm sorry. I read books. I don't have them read to me, so I don't know how to pronounce all those names.
Why don't you have anybody to read you books? That's awful.
I read too early for anybody. Actually, I don't remember anybody ever reading to me.
Oh, my God.
Even back in Russia. The Ukraine, I should say, Kiev.
I'm going to have to go in later, and I'm going to add violins to this. This is so sad.
Tom, can you read to me?
It's Dickensian.
Oh, no, it's wonderful. I read to myself. I listened to my own voice.
Anyway, with Dune, we did not finish the game. Dune can be a very long game, and we did not get started until later than usual that night.
We had a lot of fun, though.
It's such a great game. We're not going to talk about it too much because when that new copy from who is it? Deep Space Nine?
I don't know.
Something like that. Yeah. When that comes out, we will definitely be taking it for a test drive and reviewing it then. Then at Matt's game night, we played Newton and
Tapestry.
Some other people played Tapestry.
We split into two groups.
The people playing Tapestry claimed to have a good time. The looks on their faces did not bear that out, but they claimed that they enjoyed it very much.
I had a good time. I'll be talking about it.
Okay. All right. We're going to see. The people playing Newton. It was my first time ever playing Newton. Simone Luciani, what can you say? He's an amazing designer. I really, really enjoyed my first play. I probably would say that it didn't absolutely fill me with awe the way some of his other designs have. But it's such a good first play. So meaty. So many really tough decisions. So very interesting game.
I have to say, you look at the board and you have no idea what the game is about.
Which I don't know. Is that the mark of a really good Euro?
It's a mark of something interesting, and it's a mark of a particular type of game.
Yeah, yeah. What I do love is I do love walking into a convention, looking at a game, and having it be entirely incomprehensible to me. And yet, after 10 minutes of rules explanation, you know, I don't know everything about the game yet, but after just 10 minutes, I can read the entire thing. It's like you've taught me a new language in 10 minutes.
Everything on the board. How long was the rules explanation on Tuesday?
Oh, you're going to make me throw my brother-in-law under the bus? Look, Paul is a sweet, sweet person, and we love him dearly. He doesn't really explain games too often. This is one of his few games where he was going to teach it. And Matt said, "Are you sure? Are you sure you can teach it?" And he did. He did a good job.
I have to disagree with you slightly on that. Paul is my favorite rules explainer. Maybe it takes longer, but he does cover the entire territory, and I like the fact that he does it without any agenda, any hidden kind of rules that he'll hold back only for himself.
As Matt and I do constantly to you. Yes, so true, so true.
Well, I wouldn't say Matt does it.
Oh, snap. And then last but not least, at this week's game night over here at Tom's Place, we broke up into Aura et Labora and the Diluvia Project.
Yes, and friend of the podcast, Ben, brought the Diluvia Project, a game we had not played that came out in 2015.
Let me talk about Ben for just a quick second. Every once in a while in the hobby, you run into somebody that the moment you start talking games, you realize, oh my God, we are a like near perfect match. Ben is into heavy Euros. He has great taste in games, a great perspective on them. And his very first time ever at my game night, he brings a game that I've never played, puts it out there, teaches us how to play it. And I got to say, it blew me away. Diluvia Project, which is put out by Tasty Minstrel Games. They just released it in the United States, or re-released it in the United States. It was very hard to find. Is a amazing game. I have a feeling we will be reviewing it very soon because I think behind Barrage, it might be my favorite game of the year. It is a very interesting city-building game in the clouds. Now, in the clouds is just a theme. There's not much to it. It doesn't have anything in that way. And I wouldn't say that there's any mechanic in the game that is particularly revolutionary, but it's one of those games where everything intersects everything else. And the decision I make with this worker now is going to have a cascade effect to all of the rest of the actions for this entire round. And it's going to come back to haunt me or come back to bless me in ways that I couldn't possibly have quite figured out from the very first play. It's a pretty deep game.
It has one of those double scoring mechanisms where you have to switch from one tactic or one strategy to another at just the right moment to maximize your points.
Yes, yes, it definitely does. There are victory points, and then there are also prestige points. And prestige points can turn into victory points. As a matter of fact, they can be a main engine of victory points. But a lot of the buildings that you're building in the game are going to either give you resources and money, which you desperately need, or those prestige points. And figuring out when to switch your engine over, as Dimitri was pointing out, seems so far from a single play to be absolutely key. Elder came to our game night, and he brought out Ora Labora, which is a Uwe Rosenberg game that we haven't played in quite some time, and those guys had a great time playing that.
It looks a lot like Agricola. It doesn't play that way, but the art.
Oh yeah, 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 yeah. It's part of that Uwe Rosenberg pastoral theming, and came pretty much right after it. Let's move on to the news, shall we? We got a little song for that as well.
Good evening, Mr. Mr. North and South American, all the ships and clippers at sea. Let's go to press.
Game news. First thing up in game news, we have a game that is just about to come out. It is dropping any day now. Paladins of the West Kingdom. This is the new game by Shem Phillips and S.J. McDonald. Artist Mihalyo Dmitrievski.
Mihalyo Dmitrievski, yes. I assume Romanian?
I'm guessing that, I mean, the Dmitrievski could be anything, any Slav, but Michalo is sounds like it could be that. Anyway, this is another in the Raiders of the North Sea and Architects of the West Kingdom franchise.
Ooh.
Of which Elder, the professor, is quite a huge fan of Architects of the West Kingdom. I think I don't think there's a single person in our group that doesn't like it. I think some of us, it's just not ringing huge bells, but I think everybody realizes it's a very competent design.
Tom, do you remember who taught Architects of the West Kingdom to Elder?
Who taught? What are you talking about?
Paul, your brother-in-law.
I dispute that entirely.
Oh, no. Paul taught Architects of the West Kingdom to Elder, and I think that's one of the reasons Elder likes it so much.
Are you positive about this, Dimitri?
Pretty sure, yes.
Really?
Yes.
Really?
Yes. I was there in that first game.
Interesting. Okay. All right. We'll give it up. We will say that this is what has happened. I'm not sure about that. I will say Architects of West Kingdom has one fairly revolutionary aspect, which is it is a worker placement game in which there is no point at which there is a segment of a round in which you pull back your workers to be able to use them again. Built into the cyclical nature of the game are actions whereby you can get back your workers or even capture your opponent,
other people's workers, yeah.
Which is really, really good. Paladins of the West Kingdom is set in West Francia, circa 900 AD. And basically, the Saracens are scouting the borders, Vikings are plundering wealth and livestock, and even the Byzantines have shown up. So it looks to be a game very much, I think all of these games in this series have a lot of similarities, and yet they all play quite different. So we're really looking forward to getting that on the table.
And Architects of the West Kingdom also has a medieval theme.
Carolingian, right?
Yeah, correct. Yes.
Yes, indeed. So look for that. That should be out momentarily. Next game we have up. Look, we're in Essen month. All right. At the end of this month.
Why are you still in L.A.?
I'm not going to Essen. I'm not going to Essen this year. Look, Trey and Matt and I, we did Essen. We podcasted Essen. We had a big old shindig there. We had a great time. But it's also, you know what? I think we're going to save this for maybe next episode. We'll talk about it more in depth. But Essen is a very, very interesting convention. It's not exactly my favorite type of convention. It's more of a trade show than a gaming convention.
Yes, you now, mentioned that.
You still play a lot of games there, and I loved it, and I do really, really want to go back. But it's not something right now that I feel like I have to take a yearly pilgrimage to. But this is the month when everyone starts to ramp up and be excited for. Basically, the more games will be released this month than any other month of the year, and by a huge, huge factor. This is Christmas for board game designers. And one of the games we have to look forward to is Brazil. Brazil by Nuno Bizarro Santiero and Paulo Soledad. Art by Mariano Iannelli. And it's published by What's Your Game. If you've heard What's Your Game from us before, it's because they are this very, very small Portuguese publisher that puts out exactly one game a year. And their track record is astonishing. Every single year they put out a game, and I don't think there's a bad one in the bunch. But if there is one among those games that is that stands head and shoulders above the others, it was they put out a game called Madeira. Madeira is an absolute, it's a heavy, deep winemaking game that is truly, truly exceptional. And it was designed by Santiero and Soledad, the same makers of Brazil. Brazil is going to be about gold mining in the 18th century. We don't know too much about it. There's a little bit you can look up on the Geek. All I can say is that this is from the designers of Madeira. This is a game that they started designing before Madeira. But this was one of their passion projects that took a long time to finally feel absolutely right. And what I love about these guys is that they will keep working it until they get it right. I'm dying to check it out. Brazil, by all means, check that one out. Next up we've got a game called Ankh, Gods of Egypt. This is the new Eric M. Lang game. We had a joke when we were at Essen that there were 8 Eric Langs because every single place we went, we ran into Eric Lang. He stayed in our hotel, so we kept seeing him in our hotel. We would walk to the convention, and we would see him walking from the convention. We would walk from the convention, we would see him walking to the convention. We had people in, Trey would be in one hall, I would be in a different hall, and we both swore that we were standing right next to Eric Lang.
That's pretty much the experience I had with you in film school where we met.
In Ankh, you play a god of ancient Egypt competing to survive as society begins to forget the old ways so that only you and your followers remain, which actually sounds to me a little bit like Small Gods.
In fact, Small Gods is on my list of things I will be talking about, the Terry Pratchett book 10 of the Discworld series.
And in my opinion, the greatest of the Discworld series.
The first real novel. You know, he started out writing parodies and satires, and Small Gods is actually the first genuine work of literature.
And he's written
that series.
And he's written, I mean, in many of the books depart from the format of what Discworld often is, but none, I don't think, have departed quite as far as Small Gods did. It's a
singleton. It's not a guard's book. It's not a witch's book. We're maybe getting a little too insider baseball about Terry Pratchett, whom I miss so dearly.
One of the greats. Absolutely one of the greats. For those not familiar with Terry Pratchett, American Gods might be another thing that you could compare this to because they share a similar conceit. You know, if it's Eric Lang, you know we're going to have absolutely gorgeous miniatures. Go on the Geek. If you like miniatures, check out these god miniatures. They are absolutely astonishing.
Cat-headed gods, I assume. Coyote-headed gods.
All sorts of amazing, amazing things like that. Remember, this is Eric Lang. Did games such as Blood Bowl, so he's used to fairly decent, fairly good Euro games that have a strong miniature aspect. He's really one of those designers that does a good job of combining Euro mechanics with Amerithrash feel, and he's very popular because of that. I think they're really good games. That's one to keep an eye on. Next, we're going to talk about Terramara. Terramara,
Earthsea, Ursula Le Guin.
No, I don't think it's based on that.
Huh.
I don't think it's based on that. Listen, there's very limited information about this, except to say that it is coming. And when I tell you that two of the 5 designers of the game are Flaminia Brasini and Virginio Gigli, what does that tell you, Dimitri? The non-gamer, this is a tough one. This is a tough one.
Does it have anything to do with Studio Gigli, the Japanese Miyazaki?
A very good guess. No, no.
Who also did an Earthsea movie?
I will tell you, it also has nothing to do with the Ben Affleck Gigli movie.
I'm not interested then. No, actually, I am. Tell me more, Tom.
Flamini Brazzini and Virginio Gili did Coimbra.
Oh, Trey's favorite game, and one I actually also enjoy, which is unusual for Trey. And
Signore Gili also did Grand Austria Hotel. These are designers in that Italian collective that are absolutely crushing it. And
did they do Lorenzo, or am I mistaken?
Lorenzo, I think they did. As a matter of fact, yes, they did. Yes, they also
the game that you reviewed with Matt last week.
Yeah,
I also am a big fan of.
The only reason I pause is that they are a collective, and each individual person on that list, they will have, I did design this game, I didn't design this game, I was working on this one while you guys were doing that, and so on and so forth.
So it's not Lennon McCartney, it's more Queen.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. That's a very good way of putting it. Taramata is the name of villages founded around 1500 BC in the mid to late Bronze Age in northern Italy. People traveled, traded, and lived between the Alps mountain range and the River Po. So this is kind of a civilization builder game to some degree, set in the Bronze Age. Look, if you're like us and you love what these designers are doing, you owe it to yourself to check out everything they got going on. I'm just really, really happy that there's a game of theirs that we're going to be able to check out this year. Terramara, check it out.
Tom, do you feel that designers have a personal style that is recognizable the way that writers do, for example, or painters?
Some of them do to some degree. I don't think it's entirely a one-to-one relationship. I do think it's not that far from novelists, though. Novelists will do departures and sometimes grand departures, but there's a voice in their work to some degree. But I think more simply, I think that in board game design, I think there is the hot hand. I think there is I think there are people that are just knocking it out of the park again and again and again, and for 5-10 years sometimes, everything they're doing, they just happen to have their finger on the pulse of these are emergent mechanics and these are design ideas that I'm putting together in my brain in a way that other designers aren't quite yet.
And maybe it's a collective that inspiring each other and spurring each other to greater heights.
I hope so. I mean, I very much like the idea of that. I think that, I think that getting rid of the auteur theory and getting back to design as something that is a collaborative process, I think is a great thing for the longevity of the hobby. And I think it can make better games. I really do.
Cool.
So I'm looking forward to that. Interesting bit of news. Dimitri, you're the wrong person to be talking about this. Have you ever heard of a game called Dark Tower?
I've heard of the Stephen King Dark Tower books.
Yes,
is it related?
It is not in any way related. This predates the Dark Tower books by a long time.
Wow, so from the 80s or even the 70s?
The 80s. In the 80s, there was a board game that had an electronic tower, a big, tall, electronic black tower in the center. It would go in the center of a circular board, and each player would be playing their pieces on the map leading up to the tower. And when you would move your piece, you would land on a certain type of space, like you would land in a swamp or on a green space or a yellow space or whatever. You would press the button corresponding to the type of space that your piece landed on, and the tower would have a sound effect, and it would flash up what the result is. Oh, you've been attacked by brigands, or you've been, a fireball hurls down. All sorts of things like that would happen.
So the tower was your DM?
Yeah,
your electronic
it was.
DM,
it basically? It was an electronic arbitrator of the rules. Now, this was early on in electronics manufacturing and board games, and because of that, they broke all the time. They were also very expensive.
Electronics never break now, ever.
The other thing is that there was a rights issue with this game. And so it came out, it was the hot toy for that year, and then promptly disappeared. They pulled a whole bunch of copies. So there are very few. It's very, very hard to find. But Then comes Restoration Games. Restoration Games is a very interesting outfit. What they're doing is they're taking these classic old titles that nobody can find, and they're resurrecting them. They're giving them new life. Sometimes they're remaking the games to some degree. These guys have done things like Fireball Island. They've done a remake of. They have done things like Conspiracy, which was a really good deduction game. They've done that. Unmatched. And now they've turned their sights on Dark Tower. They're doing a game called Return to Dark Tower. And there is a prototype that is going around. You can see little YouTube clips of it right now where they're showing a tower that not only is going to be responding to what's happening on the board around there, but is going to do physical things, like parts of it are going to fly off and pop off and things like that.
Will it electrocute you?
I don't believe it will electrocute you.
There's a game based on that Matt bought and played with us.
I want to do the shock game one of these sessions for Turn Order.
Ooh, smart.
Right? I think we can have some
fun
with that.
Excellent idea. Tell me, is this a Kickstarter game or have they announced how they're going to be distributing it?
I don't believe it is Kickstarter. There's the crowdfunding campaign is going to start in January, so we got some time. But I think it probably will be on Kickstarter, but they haven't said exactly which crowdfunding they're going to be doing.
Which platform it is, right?
But it will be in January 2020. So we have a little bit of time. But once I found out that this was in the works, I thought, oh my goodness, that's really, really fantastic. Just two more items. One is that Isaac Childress announced at Shucks. Shucks is the Shut Up and Sit Down convention that is currently going on up in Vancouver. He announced something pretty remarkable. He announced that there is going to be a new casual version of Gloomhaven that will be produced, and it should be coming out in the third quarter of 2020. He hasn't given an official title, so I will. Diet Gloomhaven will have 24 scenarios in the box, and the box should be priced at around $40 to $50. So half or less than half of what it costs currently. Listen, we just took this game off of our 8x8 challenge because we felt it was a bear to get to the table. It took up too much time to really get through it.
Well, Jesse played it so extensively in one of his side projects or one of his side game nights that he felt that catching us up to his level of magnificent accomplishment in that game would be just too heavy of a load.
And as we all know, I mean, just keeping up with Jesse in regular gaming is nigh impossible. So why even start? Anyway, Diet Gloomhaven, I think, is a great idea. I hope very much that everybody who has the same reservations that I have, which is not enough hours in the day to devote to something. I'm not going to pay $120 for a game that I'm going to have trouble even getting to the table. Once it comes down to $40 to $50, and it's got a very, you know, densely packed, limited scenario pack, that's something that I can much more wrap my head around. So looking forward to that. And last but not least, in the world of RPGs, something amazing happened. Awful? Perhaps. Amazing? Absolutely.
Amazing used to mean awful.
It did.
And awesome used to mean awful.
Awful as well.
Yeah.
Awful. And brilliant used to mean bright. Oh, where have we come? Wendy's, the fast food chain, Wendy's, has put out a role-playing game, a tabletop role-playing game called Feast of Legends. What can I tell you about this? It is 97 pages. The PDF, the free PDF that anybody can download, is 97 pages, including front and back cover, and it has some of the best art I've ever seen. It is gorgeous. It is ridiculous. And
all the characters have to do with their menu items, don't they?
Yes, they do. Instead of the classes, the character classes of fighter, thief, druid, all that sort of stuff, they have orders. So you could be the order of the chicken, which are sort of rogues or bards, Order of the Beef, which are the warriors, and Order of the Sides, which are mages. And
Tom, which one are you?
Well, you know, I tend to enjoy playing rogues a lot, so I'm probably Order of the Chicken when it comes right down to it. But
interesting, I'm a chicken too. I feel like a bard or a troubadour.
It is absolutely ridiculous. It is kind of hilarious that you're playing characters that are essentially the idea is that you are soldiers or adventurers that are under the flag of Queen Wendy the Red, and you live in the only good place in this entire kingdom because Frisonia, where frozen patties and frozen food is made, is instead of fresh, not frozen, which is what you guys are all about. The freeze is taking over the world, and you have to go out and stop it. You have the other kingdoms which are not helpful, like the Kingdom of the Two Carls. You have the, what is the McDonald's one? I can't even remember what that one is.
Ronald McDonald.
No, yeah, but what they call it, I kind of want to get it up because it's so absolutely bonkers. It's the weirdest thing you have ever seen. You should absolutely go and check it out. It's the campaign is basically the fight against frozen beef. Freshtovia is the kingdom where you are living. Look, it's not a game. I mean, it's totally a game. You can totally play this. I don't know why you would. It's a very generic RPG, but it is done to such a loving degree. Like, it is done absolutely correctly in that it lays out everything you need to know. I don't think they ever intended for anyone to actually play this to the point where they give you a buff, which means they give you a better chance of succeeding in a role if you have just ordered and eaten a Wendy's menu item. And you get a minus on a roll if you have ordered anything that was previously frozen.
Tom, is this really worse than murdering demonically possessed villagers?
Well, look, here's the way I look at it. Somebody at Wendy's had the bright idea to, there are tabletop RPG writers who are great. They can do amazing things. There are fantasy artists that are amazing, and these people are starving to death. They are working minimum wage jobs. They're driving Ubers. They're doing anything they can to make a buck, and for a tiny marketing money outlay from Wendy's, you can create an item that every single person in geekdom is going to be talking about for days, for weeks, for months. There's going to be outrage. There's going to be faux outrage. There's going to be every single thing that you could possibly have. They have done something truly amazing, which is on a very, must be a fairly small budget. They've created such buzz. I can't remember the last time I talked about Wendy's. Who talks about Wendy's? And we are all over it because of this.
At some point, they're going to settle their lawsuit with Pippi Longstocking, I hope.
It is incredible. As long as you don't take it seriously, I think it's very funny. I think it's very fun. There are people who think people are actually going to go out, like kids are going to actually go out and play this and take it seriously. And if that's the case, what a horror it has unleashed if that is the case. But I don't think that's the intent, and I don't think that's the way
it might be the gateway game to other RPGs.
Folks, that's what we got for the news. Let's move on to Games on the Brain. Which theme do you want, Dimitri?
Oh, I think you know.
Do you?
Yes.
Because I played it last week. You want me to play it again?
No, I want to hear your sweet, sweet voice, Tom.
Okay, here we go.
Terra from Mars, Forbidden Stars, Heaven and Ale, Grey Western Trail, Too Many Bones, Game of Thrones, Oregon, Avalon, Crokinole, Blood Bowl, Time Stories, Scattergories, Rolling Flames, Codenames, Rising Sun, Cash and Guns, Scripts and Scribes, Five Tribes, Web of Power, Keyflower, Mage Knife, Arkwright, Escape Plan, Wingspan, Games on the Brain.
Yes, Games on the Brain. I have to say that having played Diluvia Project, it is seriously on my brain right now. I think it's a pretty amazing game. I'm really excited about it. And the last thing that's on my brain right now is I announced last week that I was designing a game called Orbitals. And immediately, friend of the podcast, the guy who did our news song, Mark Now, who designs LARPs with Trey and I, shot Trey and I an email and said, hey, we're all designing board games. How about we just form a little board game collective like the Italians
oh,
do?
Oh, sure, the Gili.
Yeah, and so we've been sharing design documents for the last week and kind of burning it up. We've been going kind of crazy with this, and it's been really, really fun.
Tom, tell me, is Orbitals in any way related to that super complicated NASA space engineering solar system exploration game we used to play?
High Frontier?
Yes.
I will say, because I love High Frontier so much and because it is so unplayable by anybody other than myself and my son, it is part of the inspiration. The other part of the inspiration is Seven Eves, actually.
Oh, sure. A wonderful, wonderful book by Neal Stephenson.
I think the last great Stephenson.
I agree.
Oh, how about that?
Oh, my God.
Anyway, it's going to be a game about disasters about to unfold on Earth, and the survival of the human race is going to be getting ourselves up into orbit and dealing
Seven
with that.
Seven Eves is highly, highly recommended.
Yes, totally agree. It's absolutely wonderful. Dimitri, what games are on your brain?
Well, two that we played recently. One is Tapestry, when I was playing it, I felt that I wasn't so much playing a game as the cards that I was drawing, the tapestry cards and the technology cards, were telling me a story about the civilization that I was playing. And I could respond to that story tactically. Mm-hmm. I could maximize certain events, but I wasn't in control of the events. The strategy, just the game was not about the strategy.
Are you, to paraphrase, are you sort of saying that the game played you a little bit more than you
played
the game?
The game played me, but it felt like a narrative. And I think that's at the ground of how you feel about the game. For me, having a game tell me a story is perfectly okay. I'm sure. Okay being passive. And for you, it can be frustrating. And I think that that's actually one of the goals of the game's designer. Was to make it more passive and therefore more palatable, because the game will play itself. The game will play you. The game will tell you a story about you. The character that you chose, the civilization that you chose.
You heard it here first, folks. If you like Candyland, a game where the winner has been decided by the shuffle of the cards before the game starts, then you will love Tapestry.
Well, but Tapestry actually tells a sophisticated story. Because the cards are interesting.
Does it, though?
Well, this will be something I will discuss later.
All right.
In the podcast, in my segment. The other game that's on my brain is Dune. And we just played it. Dune is a game I think we've played about a dozen times over the years.
At least.
It is a genuine game with random input as opposed to output, with unpredictability rather than randomness. The unpredictability because of other people's tactics and other people's strategies interacting with your own, incomplete information, meaningful moves, the ability to form alliances, worker placement in spice collection, card auctions, asymmetrical powers, interesting non-random combat mechanisms, asymmetrical win conditions, all of that in 1980. Way before these mechanisms became fairly standard in Euro games. And the reason that all these mechanisms, all these really sophisticated mechanisms are present in 1980 is because they're 79 is they're being faithful to a book that was published in 1965.
I completely agree. I think that there are many games that have variable player powers. But Dune sings particularly because it's not just variable player powers, but variable player powers that inhabit so closely a world that is so rich.
And that ability of game designers and game players to get inspiration for specific mechanisms from a work of literature is another thing that I will be talking about in my special segment.
Dimitri, you have plugged your special segment 4 times already. And special segments are supposed to be about 10 minutes long. Do you think you got enough, or do you need, you're just a hype beast, aren't you?
I am a beast, yes.
Moving on, we're going to talk about the 8x8 challenge. We did nothing on the 8x8 challenge except that we have adjusted the 8x8 challenge. You heard Matt and I talk about that last week. We said that we might. We have changed Food Chain Magnet to be all splatters. We have taken Gloomhaven off, and we have put Lorenzo Il Magnifico in its place. And what was the one other change we made? Good question. It'll come to me.
We also played Avalon.
Oh, that's a good point. We did. And we played an interesting Avalon, too. We played Avalon with PAX, the PAX games. We decided,
PAX Pamir and all the games with that with those mechanisms, but in different historical settings.
Correct. Instead of PAX Renaissance being on the 8x8 challenge, any PAX game will count towards the 8x8 challenge, which I think is totally fair. We did. We played a interesting game of Avalon in the sense that we played this game 300 some odd times. But this time we had 7 people and only 4 of them had played it a lot. Mm-hmm. Only 3 of them had played it a lot, actually. Sure. 4 of them.
Matt is kind of on the verge.
He doesn't play that way.
I think he actually played well. I think everybody played well. And the reason I know everybody played well is the game finished the way it's supposed to when everybody plays well.
The bad guys were ferreted out.
The bad guys were ferreted out. The good guys won. The bad guys had a discussion about who Merlin is, and we happened to guess right.
Thanks to you, Dimitri. You were the one who ferreted him out first and pushed for that revelation. The professor was unmasked.
The professor was unmasked. I feel I unmasked him a little unfairly because he played the game flawlessly in terms of strategy. But he, I think, had a misstep and spoke a little bit too stridently at one point, and my ears pricked up, and I don't know if that's the fair way to win the game.
Well, no, much like poker, playing perfectly will not win you money, right? You need to seem like you're not playing perfectly. You need to you need to affect a limp when you are strong. You need to bare your teeth when you are weak. You need to figure out ways to mix that up.
Sure. And I feel I took advantage of someone of a less experienced player, although Elder is a far more experienced player in general than I am.
Look, Elder was going through some of the things. He didn't just break down crying because of you. He was going through a lot of stuff in his life at the time. And it wasn't just that. Yes, he did scream and say, Dimitri, why did you do this to me? Why are you picking on me? I just want to feel included. But I don't think you can take that as personally as you did. I think it's just fine.
Elder, if you're listening, my apologies.
Okay, so that was the 8x8 challenge. Now we move on to the game review. Here we go. This is on our 8x8 challenge. This is one of those games that I will say I would never turn it down if it's offered up to play. And I think maybe even you, the non-gamer, would probably almost always play this. Is that correct?
I like this game. Interestingly enough, to me, it's very similar to Eclipse, but mostly because of the theme and the way the board is created, because they have no mechanisms in common that I can think of.
No, none at all, except theme. We are talking, of course, about Gaia Project. Gaia Project came out in 2017. The designers were Jens Drogemiller and Helga Ostertag, and the artist is Dennis Lohausen. Gaia Project is not a game that came from out of nowhere.
It is a remake.
Those same two designers designed a game called Terra Mystica, which until Gaia Project came out was one of our absolute favorite games of all time.
Not mine. I had a block against that game for some reason, maybe because of the fantasy theme. I just couldn't grok it at all.
Dimitri, I agree with you about that 100%. For me personally, I had a conversation about this last night. fantasy theme is a little bit of, it's like minus 1 point. When I see a fantasy theme game, I just give it a minus one, because maybe because too many fantasy theme games are big plastic minis and not enough good design. Maybe it's that it's just oversaturated. Maybe that is a theme that is severely overrepresented in the hobby. But I do sort of take a little bit of a point off of, you have to work a little bit harder if you design a fantasy theme game for me to really, really love it. But not so with science fiction. I don't know what it is, but...
I think for me, it's the fact that in Terra Mystica, Gaia Project, and many other games, you have technology tracks. Mm-hmm. And advancements in technology in science fiction is something I totally get, totally can understand. In fantasy, I just don't think of technology tracks as part of fantasy.
Well, there isn't one in Terra Mystica, but we'll
Oh, I thought there was.
There's a track, but it's not. It's a cult track, so it's not. It's not technology. You don't gain technology by it.
Well, but you can improve your digging. You can improve your terraforming.
Oh, sure.
You know, that's what I mean.
But
go on.
Got it. Well, let's get into what these games are. These are very complex engine builder games. Learning how to play these games is a teach. It is a significant teach. What you're going to have is you're going to have a board laid out in front of you. In the case of Terra Mystica, it is a fixed board that is a fantasy landscape, which has terrain of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 different types, something along those lines. There are also rivers running through it. There are little lakes and all that sort of stuff. And you are going to be placing initial settlements on those landscapes. And from then, by placing those settlements out there, you are uncovering income on your board.
And if you're already bored, then you're responding to it the way I did. Versus what happens in Gaia Project, Tom.
In Gaia Project, you are looking at a constructed map of the galaxy, map of this section of the galaxy, which means to say it is not a fixed and static board, but every game will play differently, which was a concern with Terra Mystica, especially when people that played the heck out of Terra Mystica, we were some of those people, discovered that the layout of the board wasn't quite fair to all parties. There were a couple colors that you could play that did better on the board than others, which was a problem. It is not a problem when you have a modular board and when the board is assembled. Each time you're looking at the board, yes, this particular layout seems to disadvantage red and to advantage white or to advantage blue or something along those lines. But guess what? You get to see that before you choose which power
alien
you're going to
species
play.
You're going to play.
Correct. Which gets us to the second point. This is a game with heavily asymmetric powers, and I do mean heavily. These people are playing radically different games sometimes than each other. The strengths of these individual alien civilizations are vast, and they push you toward very different aspects of the game, which is a very, very interesting thing. I love it when variable player powers are powerful, and I love it when they are balanced. I wouldn't say they're entirely balanced here, but the way that the game is designed has a lot of ways to make up for the fact that, okay, the two powers that are the silver ones, they tend to do really, you know, pretty well in the game. So guess what? They're going to be the ones that are first chosen. And the ones that are first chosen are going to be the last ones to place their people on the board and the last ones to do certain other things.
And also, they're probably going to be the first chosen by less experienced players, whereas more experienced players who want to play a different kind of game and have a challenge may pick a more outre alien species.
We'll just talk about Gaia Project, and we'll come back to Terra Mystica later. In Gaia Project, you pick your race, and your race is a double-sided board, so if you're playing the red player, you're going to start on red planets, and you have a choice of two different aliens that play very differently to be your race, and every single one of these races is that way. They all have two different choices. And those choices are stark. They are quite different, and they play very differently. After that, once you've built those initial settlements, you're going to use your limited resources to explore and colonize new planets. Any new planet that is the same color as your current planet is easy peasy, no problem. You can just plop down a new planet and a new building there and explore that at will. The problem is that galactic distances are difficult.
There are ways to combat those distances. One is to go up the technology track that allows you to travel farther. Another way is to collect a resource, a crystal that will allow you to do that.
A QIC, which is called an intelligence cube, absolutely, is one of those things. And what you'll be doing is you'll be expanding out. As you expand out, you'll be building more buildings. In addition to building more buildings, you will be upgrading the buildings that you have built. You will start, the lowest building is called a mine.
Yes, you can upgrade it to a trading post.
Correct.
Then you can upgrade the trading post to one of two things, a kind of a laboratory that you can then upgrade to university, or to a kind of a capital building.
Yes.
Now, what's interesting about the labs and universities and capital buildings is that when you build them, you uncover more game-breaking powers.
Correct. The capital building, as we'll call it, which is actually called the Planetary Institute, that's the one that unlocks most powers, player powers in the game have a special boost that happens when you build your Planetary Institute. Building your Planetary Institute is expensive. It is going to nerf your turn. It is going to damage what you can do for the rest of your turn. But if for some of these powers, if you get it up early enough, the power you gain by unlocking that is quite huge. However, if you go the other way and you build research labs and academies, every time you build one of those, you are able to grab technology tiles, and these are some powerful, powerful things. Some of them give you income that is very hard to come by. Some of them give you bonus powers and things that you can use. But let's get on to one of the really key things that all of these games do. They use a Moncala mechanism of power that is quite fascinating. What it is it is three buckets that are 1, 2, and 3, and you're going to have these little purple discs in these buckets. When somebody builds near you, you can lose a victory point to gain 2 power if you have 2 power worth of buildings that can be upgraded. If you have 1, you're going to get it for free. Basically, you lose 1 less victory point than the power that you're gaining. And when you gain power, if you have anything in bucket number 1, you are moving things from bucket number 1 into bucket number 2.
And to make that move, you have to do stuff. And then to move the power from bucket 2 to number 3, you have to move stuff. But what happens when you have enough power in bucket number 3?
When you have enough power in bucket number 3, you can do a whole bunch of things. First thing is that you can choose these power actions that are out there on the board. They're things like terraform a planet. That means turn a planet that is radically different than the one that you can live on into your color.
There are actually 3 types of planet: a slightly different, a medium different, and a radically different. And they have different costs associated with terraforming them.
There are actions where you can pick up knowledge, and knowledge is an income that will allow you to move up this research board, which will unlock more income, new technology advantages, and all sorts of things. Things like being able to travel farther for free without having to spend intelligence cubes. And the radical change, which is Gaia Formers. There are some planets out there that are purple. Now, there is no player color that is purple. These are transdimensional planets, or transdims. If you have researched the Gaia Transformer technology track, you get a Gaia Transformer, and that is going to be able to, a Gaia Former, I should say, which is going to be able to go on one of those purple planets and essentially materialize it in your space and turn it into a green, lush, verdant world that anybody can populate. But because you put your Gaia Former on it, that is reserved solely and only for you. And there are many, many aspects of the game in terms of scoring that often will give you points only for the Gaia planets that you control.
And by the way, speaking of scoring, those technology tracks, not only do they help you colonize planets and expand your empire, your position on those tracks at the end of the game also helps you score points.
Yes, it does. The way to score points in this game, it is so varied that it boggles the mind. Each and every round of the game, there will be random tiles that will be dealt out that will say, you are getting points this round for building this or for doing that.
Building mines or building trading posts or not even building them, but how many you have. Have you built your institute? Have you built your academy?
Are you terraforming? Are you building satellites in space? All of these things can score points, and putting those things out at the right time
can radically affect your strategy.
There are also final scoring tiles. There are several different types of these. You will see that at the very beginning of the game, knowing what the big end game bonuses are going to be. And the end game bonuses are something on the order of 16 points if you are first in
the most far-flung.
18, yeah.
Yeah, the most far-flung empire. Or how many different sectors have you colonized? How many different types of planets have you colonized?
Or how many Gaia planets do you own?
That's right.
So 18 points for first place, 12 points for second, 6 points for third is what you would get for those sorts of things. And then
you can play this game many times and have a very different game each time. But Tom, tell me about when you're building buildings, what do you get? What is the other reason to build buildings other than uncover powers? Why are we actually improving these planets?
Why, Dimitri? Tell me why.
Because we can actually have an empire.
Yes, indeed. We can federation.
Excuse me. We can have several federations. Would you like to explain how those work?
Yeah, very simply. A federation is a conglomeration of 7 points of power that are connected to each other.
Which could be an institute, a lab, a trading post, and a mine.
The different buildings have different point values.
From 1 to 4.
Mines start with 1, I believe 1 to 3.
1 to 3. Right.
Yeah, the trading posts and the
labs.
Research labs are worth 2, and the big buildings are worth 3 each. Now, in order to form these, there's going to be empty space in between these places. You're going to have to put out satellites, little cubes that are going to say this is forming one sort of a federation. And when you form a federation, you're going to get a federation token. And that token is going to be worth victory points often.
Not just victory points, but it might also give you resources. It might unlock special powers. It might advance you up the various technology tracks. Everything in this game is connected, and every move you make, and every decision you make, when do you form a federation? Where do you form a federation? When do you score the federation? It all interlocks, and you can literally double your points or have your points depending on the timing and the decisions you make.
The theme of this this turn is old school. When I play a game like this, it reminds me of the earlier days in the hobby. When Puerto Rico came out, we played Puerto Rico every week for a year. And we basically, you know, we would sometimes play this, we would sometimes play that, but we kept playing this one game because there weren't that many absolute masterpieces that were out there yet. And we would play it again and again and again, and it had the depth that allowed us to do that. Today, if I had to say, what is a game that, if you could only play this one game for a year, what is the game that is going to give you the best mileage and you're not going to get bored of? I would say Gaia Project is probably it. I mean, more than Splatter, more than 18XX, more than any of these things, it is the game that is going to feel the most different the most number of times, the one that you're going to be able to explore and get deeper and deeper in the more you play. it may sound confusing to you. I'm not 100% certain that when you're hearing this review, you're having much of a strong idea of what the game is. I hope that we're getting it across to you. But I will say that it is a game that is totally worth exploring.
Here's something. Here's my perspective on it. This is going to be a half hour to an hour teach. So when you have a long teach, the question is not just are you going to have fun and an interesting time playing the game this evening. Will this teach be worth it because you're going to play this game 10, 20 times with the same group of people and enjoy it every time and have a slightly different challenging experience every time? Mm-hmm. For the investment in the teach and for the also, of course, the investment that you make when you buy the game, this will be a game that you will bring out and people will be asking you to bring out. You will want to try out the different alien powers. You will want to try out different strategies. And there's so much variability in how the board gets constructed from the pieces, where the planets are in relation to each other, which winning conditions come out when. It's just, but the principle is the same. So none of this requires a new teach. This is having a new game. This is like having a PAX panoply of games in one box. And again, for me, a science fiction geek, the theme is terrific.
Let's speak about theme for just a second, because I do want to say that there are two other games, not just Gaia Project, but Terra Mystica, which came before it, and another game called Clans of Caledonia, which all of them are very, very similar. They follow similar mechanisms in their design.
Is Clans by the same people?
No, it is not. Clans design? Is by Juma Aljuju and Mehmet Essen play the game. And so here's my pitch for you. If you play Terra Mystica and you love it and you have not played Gaia Project, I cannot urge you more strongly to switch over to Gaia Project. Really simply, Gaia Project is version 1.0 of this system. And Gaia Project is, Terra Mystica is version 1.0. Gaia Project is not even 2.0. It's 3.0. It is a much, much more involved, more honed game. In Terra Mystica, the board not being variable is a problem. In Terra Mystica, the cult track that you're moving up instead of the technology track is simply a point grab. It's simply a race for points at the end of the game, whereas the technology track in Gaia Project is frankly amazing in terms of the different ways you can play that track. The different benefits and the cost-benefit analysis of going up these tracks is quite amazing. The introduction of these trans-dim worlds and the way that terraforming a planet works is a mechanic that is stands outside of the usual terraforming rules of that Terra Mystica and Gaia Project share. The green cubes, the intelligence cubes, are a new resource that gives a lot of strategic depth in terms of how you use these very powerful, very hard to get items that could be used several different ways to get yourself out of a jam or to leap ahead of the competition. Look, if you're heavy into theme and you like the fantasy theme, then stick with Terra Mystica. Everybody else, you should leave Terra Mystica and come to the stars, come to Gaia Project. As far as Clans of Caledonia goes, Clans of Caledonia went a different direction, but also is an improvement on the Terra Mystica system. It is a fantastic game of Scottish clans, and I recommend that very highly. I would say that I still think Gaia Project did more to advance the design and to really come up with a game that is extraordinarily complex and yet grokkable once you've played a couple rounds of it. So I would say Gaia Project, absolute number one. It is more complicated, but it is absolutely, as we say, the juice is definitely worth the squeeze.
And let me add a little bit of a slightly different perspective. If you're a fan of Terraforming Mars, if you're a fan of Eclipse, very different games that are science fiction themed, then Gaia Project is another science fiction game that has a completely different mechanic.
Sure.
And a completely different style of play that is still Euro, that is still strategy focused. Please don't let the skin think that you're buying something similar. You're buying something very different in a theme that you already enjoy.
So you're saying not all science fiction games are the same?
Well, I'm saying that some of them are very much the same. I don't think I've played a science fiction-themed game, a space-themed game with these mechanisms. Have you? Can you think of a similar one?
No, but the premise of what you're saying is suggesting that science fiction games are similar, and I think it's a theme, and it's not really a genre, I would say.
Okay.
So how do we sum up? If you see Gaia Project popping up at a game night, just remember, in the immortal words of Smash Mouth, hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on. Go play. That is it for game review, and now, oh boy, here we go. It is time for the member-specific segment, and when it means we're here with Dimitri Portnoy sitting ahead of us, strap yourselves in, people, all right? Take that, take that Robitussin. Now, here we go.
sure.
It is about to happen. Dimitri, I'm going to go get my car washed.
Go ahead.
Should that be okay?
Absolutely.
Ladies and gentlemen, I turn the mic over to Dimitri Portnoy, who is only tangentially going to be talking about the theme old school. Hit it, Dimitri. I look forward to this.
So how did I come to board games? What was my journey here? Half of my childhood I spent in Kiev, in the Ukraine, in the Soviet Union. We didn't have board games. I didn't have toys.
Didn't have board games?
Nope.
You didn't have chess in the Soviet Union?
I'm talking about board games where you have multiple players, not
each
just two.
Each game of
checkers,
chess
checkers,
means there's
sure.
one less.
I didn't have Jesse's father to teach me chess and play with me, but one of the things I do remember is being really excited about atlases and maps.
Me too.
And I think that has a huge relationship.
I used to put the National Geographic maps up on the wall in my room.
Yeah, we didn't have National Geographic, but like I can close my eyes now and I can see the way that a city of 100,000 residents is different from a city of 500,000 residents is different from a city of 1,000,000 residents. Mm-hmm. And I would stare at maps for hours, just plotting journeys and seeing where the population centers were,
figuring out where weak points in the border were and the guard towers.
Sure. How do we invade Alaska and stuff like that? I remember being a part of like a class of 8 brilliant 8-year-olds who were supposed to come up with strategies to conquer Florida or something.
But young pioneers.
Young pioneers. My family moved to America. We spent a year in Chicago, and then we moved to California, and that was an enormous change. Everybody should move to California. Please do so. It is a wonderful, wonderful, wonderful place to live, and almost everybody here is an outsider. It's probably the only place that I've been to where it really doesn't matter whether you grew up here.
Okay, that's interesting.
People say, where are you from? And, you know, you may be from New Jersey, like Tom. Or like Matt. Matt's from West LA, and it really doesn't matter. You know, you don't gain or lose status based on your origin. My friends did not play board games. My friends played RPGs, video games. I remember being aware of LARPs. Although at that time they weren't as structured, people would just put on clothing and go to gaming conventions. My favorite writer, Gene Wolfe, talked about how the genesis of his book of the New Sun was his desire to create a character that people could dress up as. So
just to be clear, that's cosplay as opposed to LARPing, but yeah.
You're right, but I think they're very related. I think you can't have LARPing without cosplay.
No, not true, but that's okay.
Okay.
That's okay. It's all right. Fine. It's all fine. Good.
So my friends read books. My friends listened to music. Again, one of my major victories was being finally invited to the cool kids role-playing game.
Because you know... That's when you're really in with the in crowd, when you're playing Dungeons and Dragons.
Sure, sure. But as an immigrant and a non-native English speaker.
Wait, you're an immigrant?
I am, yes.
Are you serious?
And a non-native English speaker.
I've known you 29 years. Why didn't you tell me? Dude.
Dude, I didn't even know you were from New Jersey until like a week ago.
Weird. Continue.
Okay, so reading a book was like playing a game, you know, because... I had to puzzle things out from context and explore the terrain, formulate strategies, test hypotheses. One of the ways in which I was lucky is back in Russia, I read stories by American writers and English writers in translation. Arthur C. Clarke, Ray Bradbury, Isaac Asimov, Arthur Conan Doyle, the Sherlock Holmes stories. So when I moved here, I read the same stories that I had read in translation in English. I knew what the basic plot and characters were, and I could figure things out from context, figure out the rules. So I engaged with books in a way that I feel right now I'm engaging with games. And one of the things I want to point out is most of the games we play are from foreign languages and from foreign language speakers. We play games in translation. Every week I read an article lamenting how Americans are not interested in subtitled movies, are not interested in translated books, from other languages. Well, here's an example of an entire subculture, of an entire cultural exchange where we are interested primarily, or a large segment of us are interested primarily in the cultural product of
Germans, Italians, Portuguese. Yep.
Yes.
Yep,
and yep. Hopefully soon Chinese and African and all sorts of other people.
Absolutely.
So... for me, there is a problem or a moment that is now ending, or maybe possibly already ended, where we look at stories as being exclusively about quests. And this is in part because Joseph Campbell,
Hero of a Thousand Faces, yes,
was so influential that there are thousands of screenwriting books that tell us that it's a hero's quest where there's one person or a team, but of like-minded individuals against the world, where it's...
we're leaving the normal world, we're crossing the threshold.
And sure, and all of that. But what I want to focus on is that it's conquest or survival, based on the Odyssey, where Odysseus goes out and kills a bunch of cyclopses, and that's the only thing. Versus games that are multiplayer, where everybody has agency, and where it's rules based. I mean, the key in a game is to follow the rules. If you win without following the rules, you're not really playing the game.
Your name is Jesse. Yes, continue.
But in a quest, it's about the outcome. It doesn't matter what you do to destroy the ring, whether you hire an eagle to fly you up there and drop you into the volcano.
Have been done from the get-go.
Yes, or you traipse across Moria and kill a bunch of people.
Worst plan ever.
Yes. So... a quest is, I'm going to introduce a couple of terms.
So please, everybody, open to a blank page, sharpen your pencil. Dimitri is going to introduce the nomenclature for the rest of this discussion.
So a quest is teleological. Teleological means it's only about the outcome. That's the only thing that matters. Keep your eye on the prize.
It's the journey, not the destination.
Yes.
Or the other way around.
Yeah. And the game is deontological, meaning rules-based. You follow these rules no matter what. So we are conditioned to think by Joseph Campbell and his followers, we're leaving the moment now, that books, stories, movies are about quests. But they can also be about games. And in fact, some of my favorite books have always been not descriptions of people going out to kill and conquer, to destroy the ring or whatever, but books about people playing a game, a very meaningful game where all sorts of people can have decisions and make and meaningful actions and anyone can win, and examining the rules by which those games are played. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to discuss these books. And Tom, I invite you, I think you have a couple of those books on your own. Books like Dune.
Sure.
Which I'm not going to discuss, but as I've said earlier, Dune is a game that takes its rules, very, very, very robust rules and interesting rules, from a book that describes those rules, that describes a world where there are multiple players. And of course, it's also a quest. It's also Paul Muadib's quest. But a book can be both. And a book, in fact, can be about the conflict between a quest and a game.
It's being fantastic.
Played by different characters.
So we'll be handling that next time we meet Dimitri in about 8 weeks. We're out of time, but no. It's just it was a long intro, so let's jump right into the heart of this so that we can
So Ada Palmer, the writer of Terra Ignota, please look her up. She's a LARPer.
I have looked into her a little bit.
Yes, she's a wonderful character. And Terra Ignota, a four-volume novel, of which three are currently out, To Like the Lightning, and look that up. That's volume one. The main character in that book is someone who failed in a quest and is about to embark on another one. That's also going to fail. We know that very quickly because they live in a world of rules and a world of players. In the book, 500 years from now, the idea is you choose which laws you follow. It doesn't matter what country you live in. If you want to...
Because countries don't really exist.
Countries don't really exist.
Because transportation is virtually instantaneous.
There are flying cars. They're basically... Yeah. It's a Jetsons world, and if you want to be ruled by a mortal individual, you subject yourself to Mason. If you want to be a humanist, you subject yourself to the king of Europe in Spain. If you want to be ruled by psychology, you subject yourself to a kind of a cognitive behaviorist cohort.
Well, but even it's even more tribal in the game, in the book, I should say, right? Because you join a bash, which is essentially a tribe, family, extended unit that's based on more than anything common interest, right? To some degree,
That's right. And the book is really about the clash of these rules systems. It's a meta game. It's not even about like the players. It's about how these rules can contradict each other and clash. And this failed quest person with a rule-breaking power who needs to make a whole bunch of choices.
Miracles, essentially, is what it can do.
Miracles, yes. It sounds almost as complicated as the Gaia Project.
Well, what I find interesting about it is that it's a very hopeful future, and yet it still has some very dark aspects. Like censorship is omnipresent and super strong.
Oh, the book opens with a page of censorship information that is completely incomprehensible. But once you finish it, you go back, you know exactly what it's talking about. It's a book also written in a foreign language. In many respects, it has a lot of foreign-sounding words whose meaning you have to figure it out from context.
Sure. I mean, going back to Anthony Burgess, a lot of science fiction writers do that.
Russian in Clockwork Orange.
Sure. They morph the language to reflect the, you know, a language's culture, and they use that to show what the society has become.
Absolutely.
Orwell.
One of the ways in which language in this book is different is in the future, gender is outlawed. I mean, obviously, biological gender exists.
They only refer to they.
Yes. And the narrator, the hero of the book, very helpfully decides to say, reader, I'm going to help you. I'm going to break this rule, and I'm going to call some people he and some people she. If you know anything, you'll instantly know that they mean something very different. But the further into the book you read, you go, yeah, I know this person is not a woman. But then you realize that almost none of these people that this guy that they refer to, the narrator refers to as a he or a she, has anything to do with biological gender. And that's, again, a game the book plays with you.
Well, religion, right? Religion is outlawed, and yet they have sort of a seer seeker.
The way the religion functions is you cannot assemble and kill people to promote your religion.
Because the last war was a large religious war.
Yes. So what you do is privately explore religious ideas with a person who is like a psychiatrist or a lawyer and keeps everything confidential.
Seems like it's designed to say that religion caused us some problems, but we realize the need for spiritual connection, and so we're going to give you this little escape valve or something like that.
Of course, as you might imagine, as the book proceeds, very quickly, all these rules, the rules about gender and being gendered, the rule about religion and being public about it, get spectacularly broken in many ways.
But that's great.
The reason that I'm mentioning it first is that it is, among all these things, a meditation on what it means to be quest-centered, mm-hmm. a teleological versus game-centered, deontological, and how those are opposites that are also interdependent and dependent on each other, and they will forever be tangoing and waltzing together.
Love it. Next book.
Werner Vinge, A Fire Upon the Deep, mm-hmm. Is a wonderful space opera that mostly relates to board games, in that it presents a galaxy with a complicated geography.
I'm going to apply cliff notes to your discussion here. I'm going to say the first book is a dense, very difficult to read and get through book that has a lot of merit once you get into it, but it's a hard access. Fire Upon the Deep is a much more traditional science fiction book in a lot of ways.
That's right. It's basically Star Wars with puppies. The heroes crash land on a planet where there are dog-like aliens in groups of eight that share a mind in groups of eight, and they're very, very smart.
And but space itself has areas where mental connection is more possible.
That's right. The further out from the galaxy center you go, the smarter you become, zones of thought, and also the faster you can go. It's actually variable light speed. Whereas if you go further into the galaxy center, the maximum speed slows down, and also you kind of become dumb. And that's,
which is a little, it's a little egotistical, because as we all know, we are fairly far out on the on the spinward arm.
Yes, but again, if we shouldn't be heading in, we should be heading out. That's where the action is. So that kind of map of a galaxy is very much a board game map. It's very much about how the region that you're in affects what you can do, gives you powers or takes powers away, affects how quickly you can move. Plus, part of the fun of this book is there are archives or libraries some of dead civilizations that have ascended and have left behind their knowledge. Mm-hmm. And if you discover them, you get technology, you get ideas. Perhaps you'll get possessed by an interdimensional demon.
That's literally something you can do exactly in Eclipse.
In Eclipse, in Terraforming Mars, in so many games. Now, this is a book published in 92. I'm not saying that everybody, all game designers, read this book, but what I am saying is that Werner Vinge, the writer of A Fire Upon the Deep, was onto something, part of a general conversation in science fiction that was discussing games, that mm-hmm. was discussing deontology, discussing rules, discussing geography, discussing multiple players and meaningful decisions versus going on a quest.
Sure.
Now, Asimov's Foundation.
Sure.
The Foundation trilogy. It's not really a trilogy. It's eight novellas that were published in three books. Is also very much a game. The idea there
in the sense that in the sense that there is one person who knows and everyone else is trying to figure things out.
Asymmetry, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. asymmetrical powers. There's the idea of a psychohistorian that was able to foresee the next 1,000 years of history, where the Galactic Empire has fallen apart, and how do you preserve civilization?
30,000 years, and he's trying to make it only 1,000 years of a dark age, right?
You're absolutely right. So there are multiple players that have a pathway to victory. They have meaningful choices. And here's a mechanic where somebody knows something. It's asymmetrical knowledge, like Bene Gesserit.
I would say no. I would say the psychohistorian in the Foundation series is Merlin.
Yes.
He knows what is he knows who is good and who is bad to a large degree, but if he acts on that information, he is going to change. And that's one of the great things about Foundation
series. That's right.
That's right. Which actually is it fits into Schrodinger's cat, Heidinger's uncertainty principle. Once you open that box, once you introduce your foreknowledge into the equation starts to become unknowable.
So they have to be very careful not to tip their hand.
Non-interventionist.
Yes, but every
like
50 years, exactly. But every 50 years or so, they pop out of a box. A recording of them pops out of a box, and they give advice. That's a very interesting game mechanic that shows up in Avalon. That shows up in a lot of different games.
Dune a little bit, yeah. You're right.
But it's also interestingly enough, this published in the late 40s. Nothing about it is like a quest. Foundation is a planet that's meant to preserve and resurrect galactic civilization.
Spoiler alert, two planets.
There is a second Foundation, but
shh.
But Foundation is a planet founded by psychohistorians that is supposed to preserve and resurrect galactic civilization after the period of the Dark Ages. They don't conquer. They don't go anywhere. They don't have to like travel through space to discover themselves.
They have to survive.
They have to survive. They stay put. And how do they survive? They follow rules. Mm-hmm. They follow rules that they themselves discover. Yes, ultimately, it's about survival and passing on civilization. But the way they do it is deontologically. And one of the other ways they do it is by acknowledging that people who want to conquer them or people who want to take them over are actually also game players with meaningful actions. And the way they survive is finding out the rules that the opponent is using.
Sure.
And usually either turning them against them or sometimes allying with them.
Well, the way I like to describe it is they are looking to put their finger on the scale with the lightest touch and the least number of times they possibly can to ensure their own survival so that they can keep doing that just enough.
Yes, yes. Worker placement.
Yeah.
efficiency, resources. And this is late 40s. This is after we defeat
balance. I would say balance is a big concept, and that's important.
Yes. This is after we defeated Hitler, when we're Marshall planning and rebuilding Europe. Again, this is a very advanced view of the world as multiplayer, as deontological, you know, non-apocalyptic. We're not destroying the ring. We're not defeating Sauron. We're finding a balance.
Ladies and gentlemen, something very odd is happening here. I just want to let you know I'm understanding what Dimitri's saying. I apologize in advance. I don't know what is going on, but...
No, just converting you is such a pleasure.
we're running out of time, so let's... Find your big finale. Find your wrap up. What else you got?
The big finale is that the granddaddy of all of these, the granddaddy of the quest versus the game, the granddaddy of the rules versus the end goal is Plato's Republic.
Sure.
If you remember, in Plato's Republic, the ideal society is ruled by philosopher kings.
Well, it's really, from my perspective as a fiction writer, it is an anti-poetic rant.
Oh, yeah. Who's excluded from Plato's Republic?
The poets.
The poets. Poets who are going to tell stories about quests. Poets who are going to tell us about Odysseus killing Cyclops and pillaging and all that. And
hashtag
and,
Team Homer.
Yeah, straight. Sure. That's sure. Me. So Plato really hates them. The thing I want to instill is that actually both storytelling and gaming are always present. Gaming is present in books. Storytelling, as I pointed out, with tapestry, is present in games.
And do not use tapestry. You're destroying your own argument.
I'm sorry. The game of the year, the game of the decade. I apologize.
It does not tell a good story at all.
I'm going to make it personal a little bit here. Okay. So,
wow.
Tom, your brother-in-law, Paul, who's a really dear friend of mine, when he asks me, Dimitri, why did you do this? Usually referring to some kind of mistake I made or some kind of faux pas or something hugely abominable. and I say, well, Paul, see, this happened and then I did this and then this happened and then I did this. And Paul says, Dimitri, you're telling me a story. No. I want to know why did you do this? In other words, don't tell me a story. Tell me what rule you were following.
Yeah, the logic.
The logic behind the game logic.
Yes.
That you were following. I wasn't necessarily following a rule, but I actually was. Both are important. And the great philosopher that tells us that both are important is Seinfeld. Because... you know,
Dimitri, I just want to say publicly, I love you.
I love you too, Tom. I'm going from Plato to Seinfeld and my favorite episode of Seinfeld, which is not the contest. I know everybody's favorite episode is the contest, but it's the yada, yada, yada episode.
Okay.
And it's the episode where you go, oh, so we went out to a bar that week, and you know how I'm allergic to silk. Yada, yada, yada. And I woke up in China next to the premier minister. So,
well, I believe the killer joke in that episode is we went out to a nice dinner. I had some awesome lost repesque. Afterwards, yada, yada, yada. I woke up in his bed in the morning. It's like, you yada, yada, yada over the best part. No, I mentioned the bisque.
Yes. So the moral lesson, and thank you for that wonderful thing. I wish you had done it in the New York Jewish accent. I know you're capable of it.
Wow.
But yeah, Upper West Side. You're all about that. The thing in that episode is that you need storytelling and rules. You can't just say rules and then a whole bunch of things happened and then this is the result. You need both. You need both deontology and teleology. You need both storytelling and game playing. You need both multiplayer and quests to explain a lot of things in life. you have to go through the steps. You have to tell the story according to the rules.
Ladies and gentlemen, that was the inimitable Dmitry Portnoy telling you to wake up, sheeple, and get out of your teleological constructs that are binding you to a meaningless existence.
And philosopher kings and poets should get along.
Philosopher kings can bite me. That is poets all the way. Team poet. Ladies and gentlemen, that was Dmitry Portnoy. What can I say beyond that? It is absolutely phenomenal. We're going to move right on because I really am speechless that I understood what he was talking about and actually agreed with his points. Dmitry, you're an absolute treasure, and both your friendship and your participation in this project is awe-inspiring.
Tom, I'm so honored to be here, and I feel the same about you.
Here we go. Let's do a couple game sommeliers before we get out of here. We got a song for this one, too.
Sometimes a player just got to know which game should stay, which game should go, which to play with mama, madame, abu. You got to tell me, monsieur, just what to do. Want to make an impression, but I can't get far as my 50th play of Agricola. A million games, show me the way to the master, the game sommelier.
If Pepe Le Pew could sing.
Oh, that is a smooth jam if ever
oh,
I heard
God,
one.
Oh, God, yes.
The smoothest. All right, let's see what we got here in the mailbag. First of all, thank everybody for submitting more things to the sommelier. We got a bunch of emails. Keep them coming. The more you give us, the more we're going to give back to you. Cody KW said, hi, Game Brain. Looking for suggestions for people on a map style games. I've enjoyed Root, Twilight Imperium, I will not comment, and Chaos of the Old World. However, the ways battle is resolved through dice, especially in Root, have always rubbed me the wrong way. Is there a more skill-based war game that you would recommend?
Sure, Dune. Eclipse.
Eclipse is dice. It's a dice-based resolution, so it's very much in keeping with what he's looking to not do. Dune is an interesting one. I hadn't really thought of that. Listen, Dune is six-player only. If you don't have six players, you can't do it. But if you do have six players, it is a different resolution system, closer to a mathematical rock, paper, scissors.
A unique resolution system.
Yeah. For me, I'm going to throw you two ways. I'm going to throw you to a game called Shogun or its predecessor, Wallenstein. They both are designed the same way. This is a game which incorporates a army tower or dice tower. What it is it's this 3D tower that you set up, and your armies are these little wooden cubes. When I am fighting Dmitry, I take all the armies that are fighting Dmitry and I put them into a little cup. Dmitry puts all of his armies that are defending into a little cup, and we pour it into this tower. And some of the pieces are going to get stuck inside, and some of them are going to come pouring out. Whatever pours out determines who wins and who loses. What does that do? Well, first of all, it's kind of amazing and cool that whatever comes out, those are the survivors. And if there are five of mine and three of Dimitri's, I win. Dimitri's three die, and my five are the ones that survive. If only one of mine comes out and none of Dimitri's come out, guess what? I still won, but I've lost all of those pieces for now. But only for now. When you're playing these dice games, people on a map that are resolved by dice, if I roll six ones in a row, the odds of me rolling a one the next time is the exact same as all the other times. Dice have no memory. The tower has memory because all of the pieces of mine that didn't come out are still sitting there in that tower. And when the next pour goes in, they could potentially come out. And whenever they come out, they get poured back in until it's a fight that I'm in. So my pieces, my armies, are remembering that they lost when they should have won and are coming back to fight and avenge for me, which is really, really fun. Shogun and Wallenstein are wonderful Euro war hybrids. I can't recommend them highly enough.
But remember, it's not the Dark Tower. So if it starts talking to you, Maybe
it's possessed.
Maybe you should go to sleep.
And then this one is much more on the war game side, but Friedrich, I've talked about it before. It is one of the most elegant games I've ever seen. It is a game which uses playing cards to resolve attacks. It is a regular decks, essentially. There's a couple of special cards in it, but it's regular decks of playing cards that you use. Each sector of the map has a different suit that is printed right on there. And those are the only suit of cards you can use to either attack or defend when you're in that territory. A lot of the battles, therefore, will happen on spaces that cross borders. So I am fighting in diamonds, you're defending in spades, for instance, things like that. Brilliant, brilliant mechanic. Highly recommend checking that one out. Hope that's helpful to you. I think, listen, if you're playing Twilight Imperium, you can handle Friedrich, and frankly should play Friedrich. Root, same thing. It's a plenty complicated enough game, so you're there.
Oh, but by the way, Root, possibly.
Oh, he mentioned Root. Root was one of the ones that he was saying. We'll take one more. Richard Borum said, I have a gaming group with four of us, and we like heavier games. Music to our ears. You're in the right place. Games that everyone have liked so far are Food Chain Magnet and both brass versions, which I'd class as economic games. Now, trying Root, which has also gone down well, one of the group doesn't like auctions, which means Container didn't hit the mark and rules out a whole host of classic heavy games, including any 18XX. What other heavy economic or just heavy games without auctions would you recommend? Dimitri, I don't think Pipeline has any auction in it whatsoever. Would you recommend that as a heavy economic game?
Pipeline, I would. Barrage, I think, is an economic game in many respects.
You're so right. Yeah.
There's also a board and a little bit of area control, but not like fighting over areas. Big Shoulders does have an auction. Does Big Shoulders, would you say that?
I think if they're turned off by 18XX, probably Big Shoulders isn't somewhere to send them right now.
It's a variant on 18XX.
It is.
But it's different enough for me that you might want to check out the review and see if in a former episode of the podcast and see if it is up your alley. Tom?
Yeah, I think that's fair. Like I said, I think Pipeline is one of the first places I would send you, because it's heavy without being long, which is a wonderful trick when you get that.
Same thing with Barrage.
And and Barrage, which is currently unavailable, but once it's available, boy, oh boy, we can't say more highly things about that.
Tom, if there's anything I know about you as a game player, is that you adore auctions. You love auctions. For you, it is an essential element of economic games.
Well, I think I'm really good at auctions. I think I'm really good at the market psychology.
Well, those are related, right?
Those games. Yeah. But I also think that auctions are great because they are a great balancing effect in a game. That if a game has something that it seems to be a little overpowered in comparison to something else, if you have an auction to acquire those items, that is self-balancing immediately, and in fact strengthens games a lot. It's a mechanic that used to be around a lot more, and it's been de-emphasized in our modern gaming.
What do you think the heart of the objection is? Is it that the person is intimidated, or that it takes up too much time? Or something else?
I certainly can't speak for the commenter that came in, because I don't know their situation. I would say that some people in auction mechanics and in auction games, auctions can make you feel stupid. Auctions can make you feel like I have no idea what a proper valuation is, and yet two of the people I'm bidding against seem to have a really good idea what they should be bidding on this and that other thing, and I feel like somebody is running circles around me it's very head-to-head, right? It's very confrontational in a way that a lot of your mechanics have tried to get away from to some degree, right? Mm-hmm. It's not me merely making the best decision, but me attempting to outflank one, two, three, four other people at the same time. So I think that might be it.
But I also think that that games that are really good that have an auction mechanic, most of those games are games you should be playing multiple times, and pretty soon you're not going to be quite so at sea.
I want to suggest a solution, a mechanism that I'm going to borrow from estates and suggest as a house rule, that to cut down on the time and cut down on the intimidation, you might want to say everybody only bids once.
Once a round. Well, there's lots of different bidding and auction mechanics. The great game, Modern Art, Rainer Knizia's Modern Art from 1995.
I love that game. I own that game.
Yeah, has four or five different mechanics, auction mechanics built into the game. Each work of art that comes up demands that the auction be held this way versus that way, and does a really good job of sort of spanning the gamut. So if you wanted to explore auction mechanics, boy oh boy, play Modern Art, and you'll know what hits the sweet spot for you. I don't think we can impose that on games that are designed a particular way, because each one of these mechanics has some variable cost. The once around that you suggest creates a left-right binding, which is a concept that means that the person sitting to your left or right might have
an advantage
or disadvantage. Yeah. Exactly, things like that. And that can cause some problems as well. I think that's pretty much all we have time for here. So, ladies and gentlemen, you've been listening to Game Brain, produced and edited by Tom Donnelly. Special thanks to Daedalus for incredible music. You might know him as Alfred on the show. More at Daedalus on GameBrainPod.com. You can reach us by email at Matthew@GameBrainPod.com or go to us at Twitter at GameBrain_pod. Thanks for listening, and go play some friends with games. Go simply play some games with friends. Or go make some friends with games.
Nailed it.